Yes, of course. Burl Bearer. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
Ladies and gentlemen, live from the soapily beatific hills of Encino, California, where industry and nature work hand in hand to create a better life for all of us.
Oh, lay off.
The following program is produced by Magic Matt Allen on the Outlaw Radio Network, soon to be a major motion picture starring Yulia Baskin. Produced by Rex Dale. I'm making this up as I go.
Oh, you sure are. Keep going.
Howard Lapidus, manager to the star. Co-host, fact-checker, Mark Boyer.
Hello.
Program True Crime Uncensored. And you know, sometimes it pays to be a Schwarze.
Oh, you know what?
What?
With our guest today.
Yeah.
Why do you go there?
Well, I'll explain that to you. Ron Chepsik, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much, bro.
Hello.
Now, the reason I made the comment that I would just receive so much slapping in the face for is, as it sometimes it pays to be a Schwarze. And that is, the reason I'm saying this.
Okay, go ahead.
Is that we're going to talk today about Frank Matthews for part of the show. Frank Matthews is one of the biggest gangsters in the history of America. And one of the reasons he didn't get brought down earlier was that people assumed that no black guy could have a crime organization this huge. Am I correct, Ron?
Yes, yes. That is true.
See, I'm not as dumb as I look.
Well,
no one's that dumb.
That's part of it, too. You have to give the guy some credit, too, of course. And we'll talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, the black or white, I think we get into right. This guy's life. It didn't matter what color he was. He knew how to operate.
Yeah.
But when the police had him up early, and the superiors just discounted any of the material because the guy was black.
Why don't we set this up a little?
Yeah, let's say, well, Ron, give us the backstory on this guy and where he comes from, and then I want to jump in on that.
Okay, in a nutshell, Frank Matthews, that's with two T's, was born February 13th, 1944, in Durham, North Carolina. And he was, typical rural southern kid. He got into some trouble when he was in his teen. He was poor, but he was ambitious. And Durham, was called the Harlem of the South, which gives you some indication of what kind of city it was for blacks. You know, it was a center of music, and it was called the Black Wall Street of the South. And so he grew up in this environment, and like most people want to be ambitious on the good side of the law, he wanted to be a gangster.
Well, this is the question I had, because Mark and I were talking on the way up to the show today. You're talking about the city in North Carolina. I mean, if you were going to be black, that was the place to be. I mean, you had black-owned businesses.
Yeah.
You have a high level of education, college graduates.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy could have been, one of the great industrial leaders of society.
Was he like Henry Hill? Right, you've seen our documentary,
right.
And what the law enforcement guys said. They said he could have ran if he could have ran a McDonald's, and if he had one McDonald's, he would have wanted 20 of them.
Yeah,
that's the type of guy that this was, and that environment, bred this ambitious young black guy back in the '60s when he shouldn't have been ambitious either side of the law, either as a criminal or as a legitimate person. You know, in those days, the crime was run by the La Cosa Nostra, and they controlled the drug trade. And he left Durham. It's not clear when, but I think he was about 17 or 18 years old, and went to Philadelphia for a while. Got in a little trouble, nothing serious. He entered the policy racket, which is big in the black community.
What is the policy racket?
Well, the numbers.
Just
numbers and the numbers racket. And so he was a runner for the numbers game, and he was a barber on the side, and then he moved to New York for reasons I haven't been able to determine yet, and ended up in New York and was doing the same thing, and he saw the opportunity. He saw the burgeoning drug trade, heroin, soldiers coming back from Vietnam, and the potential for drugs.
Wouldn't you say that he ran to New York following the drugs? And maybe that's the reason?
No. I don't think so. I think he just... there was some controversy surrounding why he left Philadelphia. Some people say he was run out of town. He got into some trouble, but they don't really know why. You know, they never really explain why. I think he was looking for opportunity, period. And he did find it in the numbers. He was making really, really good money in the numbers, from what I was told. But he wanted more. You know, he wanted to be, big in crime, and he saw the drug trade as being that opportunity. Of course, he had a big roadblock, La Cosa Nostra, in those days, and in order to enter the trade, this was back in the 60s, before the French Connection broke up, you needed the permission of La Cosa Nostra, and according to one of the stories I heard, he went for a meeting, and for whatever reason, they turned him down. And that's when he began to look for another outlet, which would give him the opportunity.
He wasn't going to be stopped, basically, is what it comes down to.
No. I mean, and if you look at his criminal career, this is the way the type of guy was.
But didn't we have racism in La Cosa Nostra? Seriously.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, they were... there was a lot of racism, but the way that
don't trust them with Moulin Young. Yeah, I mean that's what
right.
That is.
Right. I mean, the blacks were the handmaidens of the drug trade. You know, they did the dirty work on the street, selling the drugs, and they couldn't really rise any higher. You know, they couldn't be a drug kingpin like Matthews and some of these others like Nicky Barnes or Frank Lucas became later. On that then, so they, you know, he was stymied, but blacks wanting to enter the drug game would have gave up, but Matthews wasn't that type of person. It really showed his personality, because he eventually found a way out of the dilemma of not being able to enter the drug trade.
But he just go around these guys, didn't he?
Well, yeah, he fortunately, you know, he became friends with a numbers king, who was the biggest numbers king in Harlem, and he was Puerto Rican, and he introduced him to a Cuban named Rolando Gonzalez, who was a big drug dealer in New York at that time. And Gonzalez got in trouble with the law, and he jumped bond and fled to Caracas, Venezuela. And according to what I've told and what I've read, he gave Matthews his first a kilo of cocaine, sold it for $20,000, and said he was going to Venezuela, where remnants of the French Connection were establishing themselves in Caracas, and he said that he would have really good contacts there, and that once he got established, he was interested, they could maybe work out a pipeline from the United States coming in through Caracas. So that's how he got started, which sort of end-run the La Cosa Nostra.
Now, I'm surprised the Cosa Nostra didn't try to put some heavy squeeze on him there.
Well, if you've seen the documentary, right. it was a very tense relationship for as long as Matthews, was around New York City. I mean, you know.
In fact, I want to mention to people when we say the documentary, what we're talking about, there's a DVD out that is absolutely incredible. It's about an hour and 40 minutes, called The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. And it is a great, great DVD, and we're just really excited to have you on the show. So we got that, and we'll mention that some more, but keep going.
Right, on that then. So, he was able to establish this pipeline. And, of course, law enforcement in those days really, you know, they're always behind the radar. You know, when they start off investigating, the bad guys are always ahead, and it takes a little while for the good guys to catch up in their investigation. But they didn't know this guy was on the radar until 2 years after he got established, and by that time, he was in 21 states across the United States, which was unheard of, because most of the time these drug dealers were operating in their neighborhoods. You know, they're essentially neighborhood operations, and if you're in New York, you probably never ventured outside of New York. You did all your dealing. But here you had Matthews essentially establishing McDonald's. He was franchising drug operations in cities all along the East Coast, and as the prosecutor that eventually went after Matthew said, if he never got stopped, he could have ruled the world. He could have been one of the, you know, maybe the biggest, without question, an international kingpin of unparalleled stature.
Amazing. We had Freeway Ricky Ross on the show a couple of years ago.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, a great guy. Very fun to talk to.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was doing millions, and he had stuff going all over the United States. He didn't have it franchised out quite to the degree, business sense, that Frank did, but the money was rolling in so much they didn't have time to count it all.
Well, you know, in the documentary, we talk about that, where Matthews would leave $40,000 in a trunk, and somebody would remind him that the money was there. And, you know, he'd say, well, if you're worried about it, you keep it, MF, you know, mother.
Yeah, you can say
you know,
that. Yeah.
You keep it. And that we have several examples in the documentary of guys that worked with him back in the 70s that, you know, talked about the character. What's really amazing about Matthews is, you know, you talk about some of these guys like Barnes, Nicky Barnes, Frank Matthews. You know, a lot of people dislike him. You know, they just don't like everybody we talked to. Nobody had a bad thing to say about this guy. I mean, it was just unbelievable. I mean, even the good guys, you know, had this grudging respect for him. They, you know, they like to catch him, and we could talk about that later. But I mean, they like to catch him. But you know, they still had this
admiration.
Respect.
Yeah,
right. Admiration for him, and that's why I got really good cooperation with law enforcement, because they're really curious to find out what happened.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that you bring up, because I ran into the same thing when one of the first true crime books I ever did was about a guy in the Secret Service. Loved him. I mean, they were trying to catch him, but they admired him and respected him.
That's right. And Frank Matthews, you know, he was bigger than life. You know, and sometimes I have to actually stop, because the character he reminds me of is Kaiser Sose.
Yeah.
In Unusual Suspect. You don't know if the guy's real or not.
And poof.
Because, you know, I never, you know, the thing that amazes me, and I'm doing a book now, which, of course, as you know, bro, it takes a lot more work than a documentary.
Yeah.
So I'm doing research, and I found some woman that knew. I can't believe how many women this guy had.
Oh, I'm
I
sure.
Mean, he had,
it makes Lou Alcindor look like an amateur.
Hundreds of women. I don't know how he had time to do a drug empire and still have time, you know, to hang out in the bedroom.
I know what it's like to have one around.
This would be
that's
bad
right.
enough.
One, yeah, right.
Mark
one
C.G. Boyer, I believe, has a question. Mark, do you have a question for Rod?
Yeah, well, you know, if you have an opportunity to shtup, you're going to find time to do it.
Yeah, well, that's
from my research,
you might want to try that sometime.
Time management, right?
No, he seemed to be very generous with those around him. You want a car? Pick a car.
That's right. And he was smart in that respect, because, you know, if you're generous with people around you, that breeds loyalty.
Well, they hold your back, that's for sure. I mean,
that's right.
You don't want to kill the cash cow.
No.
That's right. But, you know, people are loyal to you. And one of the unusual thing about this is, because I interviewed all the major, I'm still interviewing the investigators that were trying to track down Matthews to find what happened to him, they never had any informants. You know, not one informant. I mean, which is quite amazing in this world of the snitch, eh?
You've got guys who are head of crime families who are wearing wires nowadays.
That's right. And you know, that's one of the major ways, you know, to catch somebody is through a snitch. And they never had any reliable evidence from informers what happened to Matthews.
We got fear going here. But what attracted you to this story, Ron?
Well, I was... I just finished my first crime book called The Cali Drug Lords, The Rise and Fall of the Cali Cartel, and the biggest crime organization in history out of Cali. And I was looking around I was really enthralled with writing true crime, and so I was looking around for another project. And I got
what do you do for a living?
Well, at that time, I was a university. I'm a full-time writer, a documentary producer now. But at that time, I was a university professor. And I was able to justify these research projects as part of my research as a faculty member. So I was quite lucky in that, because some of them took, you know, a lot of time. But I was looking for my next project, and I was watching some old blaxploitation movies from the 70s. You remember them?
Yeah, Black Godfather.
Black Caesar, right, Shaft.
Yeah.
And I love them. And
why do you love them? I mean, they're not the greatest Shaft.
No, they're exciting, interesting. I love the dialogue.
Cleopatra
I love the characters.
Jones.
You know, I love the clothes. You know, I love the ambience for the period. I just like watching them. I mean, you're enjoyable. You're right. I mean, you know, they're not great art, but they're to me at least, they're fascinating.
Great slice of culture, pop culture.
Right. So, and more, you know. Most of those books were like set in Harlem, and I said, "God, I said Harlem must be a really interesting place to, you know, for crime." And I wanted to get a book on it, and I couldn't find a book on.
So you wrote it.
I wrote it, Gangsters of Harlem, and I trace, you know, the history of crime in Harlem on that. And then one of the characters I stumbled on was Frank Matthews, and I did a chapter on Frank Matthews, and you know, pretty well outlined his life and all that. And I said, there's got to be more to this. And this project took me like 5 years before I finally got off the ground. I had a couple of people I was working with that were doing documentaries, and never worked out. And I was, you know, sidetracked by other projects. But finally, last fall, Al Bradley, he's the co-producer, co-director on the documentary with me, talked me into going ahead and doing it. He says, because so many of the, at least five key sources died in the last 2 years.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, you got interviews with guys that had, I would think they must have just got out of the slammer recently.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, like Matthews would be 68. So most of the people that he's dealing with are in that age and higher, you know. And I'll tell you, these guys live fast and heavy. I mean, when I went down to Durham to try to locate some of the homeboys that were that knew Matthews and all that, you know, I'd find them on respirators, on walkers, and much older than their age, you know, like they're late, you know, they're only in their late 60s, and, you know, they're like 80, 85, I mean, and so I realized, I said, you know, like if I wait much longer, I said,
they're going to be gone,
know, yeah. Oh, yeah, they're going to be gone, you know, and the, you know yourself, bro, when you're doing a book, court records are invaluable, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right, and there are no court records with Matthews. I mean, there are absolutely nothing.
Were they purposely destroyed? Because this is leading to something I wanted to talk about. But go ahead.
No, he never went to trial for anything. Just that minor case.
So you have to look for like corollary cases.
Right, right. Well, what happened was 18 of his associates were indicted about 15 or 16 months after he disappeared. And I said, great, because there was 40 witnesses in there. And I knew there was a lot of, you know, really good background stuff that you can't reconstruct through interviews because of the time lapse, right? So I went looking for them. I went to the National Archives. The records, they can't find the records.
What a surprise.
Yeah, I don't know what happened.
I've seen actually the sentencing documents on people disappear so they don't get out of prison.
That's right.
Where's Frank Matthews?
Duh.
See, there's the question. Is he, you know, the interesting part that I don't think we've gotten to yet is that when he took off in 1973, he packed about $15 to $20 million in his pocket, which in today's money is like massive.
It wasn't too small then either.
No,
about $90 million. They estimated about $90 million.
Guy takes off, and I mean, did he go to Venezuela and hang out with those guys and just live the life, and that be the end of it?
Well, I mean that is the mystery.
That's the $90 million question.
Well, right, because you see everything about Matthew. I mean, it's like Kaiser Sose. You don't know what's true and what's not true. Like, for example, I was told by Gerald Miller, who was the key guy, head of the investigation, that they had evidence that Matthews was putting away about $1 million a month, about 15 to 20 months before he disappeared. And that's how they came up with this figure, this 15 to 20 million, right?
Where was, when you say putting it away, where would that go?
Well, in money, you know, he was putting it somewhere. And in those days, there weren't...
Oh, yeah, it wasn't going into the bank account.
No, they don't know for sure, because in those days they didn't have the money laundering laws like they had today. You know, there was hardly any kind of
But the government monitored those major deposits for tax purposes.
No, he didn't do that. No. I mean, really.
Let me get my late father on the phone. He'd like to know that didn't happen.
I mean, like, I did a book on Sergeant Smack on Ike Atkinson. And, you know, he had his lawyer bringing money out to the Cayman Islands. And if the lawyer never snitched, they never would have got that money. I mean, no, there was none of that electronic stuff they have today and all that. And I've asked everybody. Nobody knows what happened to the money, you know, what happened to it. And so when he disappeared... you know, he just
evaporated,
vanished. And the last place they know, this is what the prosecutor told me, is that he was in a plane that landed in Texas, in outside of Houston, and that's the last place that they know him to be, or they suspect him to be. Even that's not
Well, you know, as I once posed the question to Andrew DiDonato, who has had some people trying to kill him, I said, who's 5'3", has really long blonde hair and large breasts? And he said, who? And I said, you, if you got a brain in your head. So, I mean, he could look like anything. We're going to take a 60-second break. We'll be right back with Ron Chepcik on True Crime Uncensored.
If you own an iPhone or ride the plastic pony in front of Kroger, you are no longer tied to your computer. You are now free to roam and take Outlaw Radio with you everywhere you go. Grab an Outlaw Radio iPhone application, the smoking, drinking, interrupting, did I say interrupting? 24-hour party that you follow now follows you. Your iPhone is now the easiest way to stay connected with your friends at Outlaw Radio, like me. Change the way you listen to the radio 7 days a week, now available at the iTunes App Store.
Back to True Crime Uncensored.
Yeah, and? Are we done, or are you going to play some more?
With Burl Bear and Howard Lapidus.
And what about what's his name over here?
Featuring Mark C.G. Boyer.
And the woman with the Hooters.
And sometimes Marie Mekke Esquire.
Hello.
Produced by Magic Matthew Allen.
Who's the leggy blonde?
Who in turn is produced by Lori Downey Jr.
Okay, got that squared away. Jeez. Welcome back.
Here yet.
True Crime Uncensored. I'm Burl Bear, Howard, Mark, Ron Chepcik's on with us. The brand new documentary, it's a DVD that I strongly recommend. The Frank Matthews story, Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. Absolutely fascinating.
Where is that available?
It is available.
Well, the best place, if you want instant digital download, you could have it right after you listen to the show. You can go to our website at frankmatthewsstory.com, www.frankmatthewsstory.com, and you can also buy it there. You could buy the physical copy. You could buy it through Amazon, and several outlets too are carrying it. But the best place is to go to our website, and you'll have it either instantly with digital download, or you could have the physical copy in 3 or 4 days.
This is no sloppy production, folks. I mean, this is, we're talking first class here on this. Very impressed.
Thank you.
Very impressed
with
the quality on this thing.
Right.
Okay, where were we? Oh, I was going to say, when he takes off, this Frank Matthews guy disappears with $15 to $20 million, he had something or a bunch of it stashed in a safe deposit box. He goes to the bank, right?
Well, see, they don't. This is another thing they don't know. What they do know is, well, one of the people we interviewed was an IRS agent that was assigned to the case, and Ron Taylor, and he tells a story in the documentary where he got word that after Matthews had fled New York, this was like within the same day that he was down in Durham, and he was at a bank on Main Street, and so he went rushed down there, and he rushed to the bank, and he asked somebody when he came in, one of the officials at the bank. He said, "Is there a Frank Matthews here?" And the guy said, "Oh, he just went out." I said, "What was he doing?" He says, "He was going through his safety deposit box." And he rushed out to the back, and he looked, and he saw the car leave. He didn't see Matthews, but he saw this car, which he assumed was Matthews. And that's supposedly the last sighting anybody ever saw of him, for sure. I mean, that they could document.
Yeah, wow. He now lives as Salman Rushdie.
Well, he was reported, you know, in 50 states. I mean, they had a special task force. They had these CENTAX, which were these special investigative units that went after the biggest of the big. And he was number two. And they assigned initially 15 agents to try to get Frank Matthews. And they were very confident they were going to get him, right? After all, you know, they always get their man.
Oh, yeah.
And they were working around the clock. And around the clock, and it went on for a couple of years until they turned it over to the marshals, and the marshals took over. But yeah,
I always loved the department store too.
But Ron, you know, you're one of the handful of people that have really researched this guy outside of the authorities. I mean, really, really researched him. And this guy had an ego. He had this lust for power and profit.
Right.
And to just vanish at how old was he?
he was 1944, 73, so that's, what, 29. He wasn't even 30
okay,
yet.
Guy wasn't even 30 years old yet, in the absolute prime of his testosteronic right, right okay? This guy decides to disappear, or...
That's right.
Or... I mean, is he capable of absolute disappearance, you know, I mean, off the planet?
Reinventing himself as James
Woods.
That's
the question I debate every day when I'm researching this guy, is how can he do this, given his personality, given the way he lived, you know, given his penchant for crowds, for people. He loved he loved crowds. He went through all the big fights, Corey, Ali.
He's one of those guys. We've seen this guy time and time again. We know, kind of get the makeup of this guy. You know, he's a narcissist, you know, of the first order, and a killer.
Is he a killer?
Yeah.
Well, there's no... there are a couple instances where I was told stories, but they weren't verified. Where he
but
had
come on off
killed.
The off the record, it's just us kids, right? I mean, this guy was a killer, and that's how he maintained and was able to keep his power. He hurt people to the nth degree, and now he disappears. Now he just coincidentally in a kind of a battle with the Bonanno family and the Gambinos. Mm-hmm. Now, was he murdered? I mean, how does a guy disappear?
You're right. I mean, how can this guy? I mean, he would have to be the smartest guy, the most disciplined guy of
which
all
he
time.
Appears
I
to
mean,
be.
All gangster of all time. Because eventually, they make a mistake or doing something.
Sure.
But you can disappear. You can disappear for like 16 years, whatever it was, 16 years for Whitey Bulger.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that. Yeah,
right. That there was a terrorist in that hijacked a plane a couple months ago. That was even longer than Frank Matthews.
But
hang on a second. They found them in Portugal.
Ron. If you'd use the Whitey Bulger comparison, Whitey at that point when he disappeared was 60 years old and change. He pretty much lived it.
Yeah, but the point I wanted, Howard, if I can interrupt for a second, Ron, the point I wanted to get about Whitey is that they didn't want to catch him right away. He knew too much about the corruption of the FBI back home. They wanted him to sit out there for a while to let things cool off.
Well, my point, I was going there too. He was not going to get caught. He's just going to relax in Santa Monica until they felt like catching him. But this guy here, how do you talk about discipline, bro? This guy would have to have more discipline than I've ever seen in a human to be able to put down his narcissist number, you know, take it from 18 to 3, and just totally not care anymore at the age of 29.
Or he could have complete plastic surgery, a melanin reassignment operation, and he could be, one of the Mendelin brothers.
Unofficially, that's true. But there are dozens of people that claim that they're in contact with Frank Matthews, or they met Frank Matthews. I mean, unverifiable stories I heard. Like, for example, I heard one police officer in Philadelphia told me that one of his informants from the 70s that knew Matthews told him that he was at a party and he got a little rough with his girl, and he heard this voice behind him. It just brought chills down his throat. Now, Matthews, he was a macho guy, but he had a high pitched voice, you know, like Flip Wilson. You know what I mean? It was like of course you never laughed at this guy because he was tough as hell. But I mean, it was a distinctive voice. You know what I mean? A very distinctive voice. And this guy, you know, he turned around and he didn't recognize the guy, but he recognized the voice, and that was Matthews. And there are all kinds of stories. There's a story in Durham told, and these people are nuts. I mean, these people are very, they look at you like they're telling you a story that can't be refuted. One guy told, I was told by two or three people in Durham that he showed up a couple of years ago for a funeral dressed as a woman. And then somebody said, nah, Frank would never dress up as a woman on that. And somebody said, yes, he would, because he had a great sense of humor. You know, he would show up at this thing dressed as a woman. And there's another guy I was trying to interview, and I'm still trying to interview him, but he's been hesitant to talk to me, but to a third party. All of a sudden, this guy said that he wanted to talk to me, and the guy asked him, "What? Why? When did you change your mind?" He said, "Oh, Frank had called me, And and the guy said he
his
did.
Ego.
He said,
yeah, he wants you to.
Well, he said he did, and so I asked the guy. I said, where was Frank supposed to be in Chicago? And so he said that that this guy told him that I wanted to interview him. And Frank said, well, it's about time that somebody did my biography, you know, and got it right. And, you know, there's stories like this, all kinds of stories like this. So
you're liable to get a call from Frank.
Right. Officially, he disappeared. And unofficially, there are all these stories floating around, you know, in the background.
What's the statute of limitations on him?
Well,
for what crime?
That's a good question.
What's the crime, bro?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Well, a drug conspiracy. There's no murder charges against him.
Well, what, after 7 years, isn't he home free?
No. He's still outstanding. Well, he jumped bond too, so he's got the bond. My own feeling is that if he came back today with a good lawyer, I think he could beat everything except the jumping bond, and he'd probably get 2 years. But it'd be like Whitey Bulger, where the law would be very embarrassed by him. Mm-hmm. The fact that he showed up after 40 years, and they would try to bury this case, because the longer it hung around, the more embarrassing,
it would be
for them. Now, we haven't even talked about Sherrod Brown, right?
No, let's talk about that.
Sherrod Brown, another mystery. And a couple of the people have approached me, about the documentary, and saying that, they were related somehow. This was through email, and they
explain who she is.
Pardon?
Explain who she is.
Well, Sherrod Brown was a young girl. She was either from Queens or Brooklyn, and Frank Matthews met her in a nightclub. She was about 23. And as Charles Clinton describes her in the documentary, she had a Halle Berry, quality about her. She was very, very pretty and all this. And she was, like, from the right side of the tracks. Her parents were school teachers. She was middle class, black. But there was this attraction. And Frank, at the time, had a common-law wife, Barbara Hinton, and three children. But that didn't stop him. He had girls in every city. But they hit it off. And now... she disappeared at the time that Frank disappeared, and the assumption is that she left with Frank. But again, Frank Matthews' story, there's nothing, there's no evidence that actually happened. It's a good assumption, but whether it's true or not, it's unproven. And she has completely disappeared, like Frank. The marshals put a trace on her parents' house for like 5 years. There wasn't a call, and she was supposed to be very, very, very close to her parents. The marshals told me that they concluded their parents didn't know anything about her. They were devastated by her disappearance, but they didn't have any knowledge of the case. Now, a young girl, 23 years old, and very close to her parents, never calls them in 5 years. You know what I mean?
Well, under the categories, I'm going to go dead. But who would want her dead?
Well, we could get into that because, he had $15 to $20 million with him.
Okay,
and
so
he was on the run, and we know he got to Texas. According to the prosecutors, now he had contacts in Venezuela, and you remember in the documentary we talked about the CIA, right?
Mm-hmm.
The CIA got involved because Frank was dealing with some real nasty characters, Corsicans, that were, involved with Nazi Germany, during the Second World War in France and all that. But they were, good guys because they had information to fight communism. So the CIA cut off the...
The allegiances here just drive me crazy.
Huh?
The allegiances, the way the allegiances change. You got these Nazis running smack, cooperating with the CIA because we're fighting the communists.
That's right. And what they did was they cut off the Venezuelan part of the Frank Matthews investigation. And the way Frank got indicted was that they busted 8 to 10 gangsters in Venezuela. Most of them Corsicans are involved with this drug ring that Frank dealt with. Now the really interesting thing. And so this led to the indictment because one of them, a guy named Marcello Cabot, his real name was Garcia, finked on Frank, and that's where they got the smoking gun against Frank. So, but what happened was 2 years later, I learned that they dropped all charges against those guys. Isn't that weird?
Well, they probably were told to drop all the charges.
Well, that's right. I mean, so none of them got... And so here you have Frank out here in the cold, and I think, you know, they're just, you know, it's there could be a possibility that he was whacked because maybe he knew too much.
Yeah, but if he was whacked, he wouldn't be calling people saying, go ahead and talk to us about time someone's in my biography.
Well, now, that's all rumor. You know, maybe these guys are BSing me. Maybe they're telling it, too. We don't know. That's what I'm saying.
No, they got no vested interest in BSing you that Frank called them, though. See, I got to look at it from that standpoint.
Maybe they see angels, too. I don't know. Maybe they're nuts.
Yeah. Hey, Ron, who is it besides, you know, guys like you that did the documentary? Who's now really out there looking for this guy?
Well, that's, you know what? I'll tell you who's looking for him. Really, and the law enforcement will get furious when I say this. Nobody. I'll tell you why.
That's because, what it smells like to me, and that's why the question. Then go
ahead. Okay, well, let me explain why.
Please.
Because, why I know they're not doing anything.
Okay.
Because Barbara Hinton, his common law wife, I mentioned, went to Cincinnati, and everybody I talked to over the last 5 years talked like she was alive. And I called up the grandson of Frank Matthews, contacted me, and so I started a conversation with him, and I sent him a copy of the DVD to the family, and I said, well, how did Frank Jr., because Frank Matthews' son, like it? He said, all right. And then I said, did you like it? He said, all right. And I said, well, what about Barbara? He said, Barbara, didn't you know? And I said, what do you mean? She died in 2003. So they don't know. They haven't been following this investigation at all. So he's scot-free unless he makes a mistake. If he's still alive, that is.
Well, it's only 68.
What's Junior doing? What does he do for a living? I mean, he wasn't that
old at McDonald's.
Well, you know what's really interesting is if you remember the documentary, we talked to the tutor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the tutor was saying that the kids were well behaved and all that. And after Frank disappeared. The kids, you know, they just fell apart. They got into all kinds of trouble. One of the sons is in jail now. The other couple have been in jail, too. So that's another reason why, whether he's alive or not, because Frank was a good father. And then he just appeared like that, leaving his kids, you know, without a father. And, I mean, I haven't had the opportunity to talk to him yet. I'm hoping to arrange an interview with them to find a little bit more about, you know, the family background, if they'll talk to me. And there's a tremendous amount of loyalty to Frank. It's hard for people to talk because they think I'm trying to find him. I said, if 15 agents in 76 couldn't find him, you know, what makes you think that whatever I do?
You know how you'll find him is he will find you. You know, because no one expects him to. It's like when they didn't expect Howard Hughes to make that phone call saying, I wish I was still in the movie business.
Well, you know, I do get some calls in the middle of the night where I go, hello, 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 and then click.
Yeah.
And you wonder, you know.
Yeah,
right. You wonder who's on the other end.
Hey, when you write true crime, you got to be prepared for that.
That's Burl Bear calling you. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. It's the heavy breathing.
Okay.
Yeah, tips you off.
He does you, then he gets to me about 10 minutes later. It's just not a pretty
right.
thing.
I have his phone number blocked.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Mike.
You're the one that should keep it open.
Because you like the heavy breathing.
There you go.
Now,
Ron, where did you fackle? When you were a faculty person?
Winthrop University in Rock Hill, South Carolina. I'm Canadian by birth. And,
oh, yeah, whereabouts? Where are you from?
In Thunder Bay.
Thunder Bay, Ontario, of course.
Yeah, Ontario.
Well, I know it well.
In the tundra.
You and Paul Schaefer, you know that?
Oh, yeah. Paul Schaefer's from my hometown.
Yes, he is.
So, yeah, right. My brother went to school with him.
Is
my
that
brother
right?
Was, my brother went to school with him. Yeah, he's one of the proud achievements of Thunder Bay. But I ended up down in the South, and I was a faculty member, and then you know, that's where I started writing freelance, not writing scholarly tomes, but freelance. I started off.
When did you leave Canada?
I left Canada when I was 19.
Okay,
and I went to school, and I came back for 1 year, and spent the rest of my time in the United States. In 88, I went to Columbia and missed my plane and met my future wife.
Hey, heck of a deal. We got to take a 60-second break. We'll be right back with Ron Chepsik, the Frank Matthews story, Gangsters of Harlem, Motown Mafia, Murder City, all coming up after the 60-second break.
If
you own an iPhone or ride the plastic pony in front of Kroger, you are no longer tied to your computer. You are now free to roam and take Outlaw Radio with you everywhere you go. Grab an Outlaw Radio iPhone application, the smoking, drinking, interrupting, did I say interrupting? 24-hour party that you follow now follows you. Your iPhone is now the easiest way to stay connected with your friends at Outlaw Radio, like me. Change the way you listen to the radio 7 days a week, now available at the iTunes App Store.
Hi, I'm the legendary Burl Bear, raised on records, born to rock and roll and write true crime. We've had some great guests on the show, such as Kathleen Ramsland and Amanda Lamb, both crime hotties. Well, imagine Burl Bear between the covers with Amanda Lamb and Kathleen Ramsland, and you'll just have a peek into the brand new book, Masters of True Crime.
That's like an alarm clock.
Yeah, 17 true crime writers all in one book called Masters of True Crime. Hey, I'm one of them. I'm a master of my own domain and a master of true crime. Get the book now from Prometheus Books, and you'll be so excited you'll say, wow. And now back to our regularly scheduled programming.
Yes, of course. Burl Bearer. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
I bet Kathleen Ramsland and Amanda Lamb are really thrilled with that spot I just did.
The two of them are just home going...
Wow.
Why didn't we write this with Howard Lapidus?
A Burl sandwich. Fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, it is a good book, I would say. Even though I'm in it, it's a good book.
99 cents, if I'm not mistaken.
No. That's.
Oh, that's the cheap... Oh, that's the other one.
That's the short stories by Burl.
Yeah, that's the short. Yeah,
nobody's perfect. Yeah, short stories.
Speaking of being able to buy something almost instantaneously, Ron, how do we get a hold of the documentary? One more time.
The best way to go is to Frank Matthews movie.com, www.frankmatthewsmovie.com, and that's the website, the official website for the documentary. And you could instantly digitally download it right after the show, kick you about 1 minute. And if you want the physical copy, you can get it there too. You can go to Amazon and purchase it, and or else you can go at some outlets in some of the major cities to carry DVDs. We'll be carrying our documentary as well.
But as a person that sometimes does that, produces the odd documentary. I highly recommend this. It was a fascinating hour and 23 minutes or whatever it is. It flies by. It flies by, and it tells the story of this guy, Frank Matthews, who we're talking about today. And it causes so many questions for me. That's why it was just going to be a ball to have you on the show today.
We're planning to do number two, the sequel. You know, at the end of the, you remember there was a part two coming,
right?
Because the story is so rich and so big, we just barely touched the.
One of the things, you mentioned the CIA and them telling them to back off.
Right.
I had wound up through a strange set of circumstances getting all the original FBI files that belonged to an FBI agent. One of the biggest drug busts in American history was a marijuana bust, actually, in Detroit. A huge amount. And they had the FBI had been smuggling drugs to find out who the other drug smugglers were.
Oh, is that similar to selling giving cards to the Mexicans?
Right.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. Yeah, right.
Anyway, so they go to bust her, and they have the name of the guy at the top, the very top. And they're going to go after him. And the CIA comes to the FBI. This is right there in the report. It says, no, you can't touch this guy. They say, why not? He's a contractor, very highly connected with the White House. There's pictures of him with the president. The guy's untouchable. You can't go there. And, and when we look at the Whitey Bulger thing, where they let him sit out there because they didn't want him embarrassing the FBI. And we had Georgia Durante, author of The Company She Keeps and The Player's Guide to Playing On. She said that when she wrote her book, she wasn't afraid of reprisals from the mob. She was afraid of reprisals from the feds because she was delivering money to the feds. They were laundering the mob's money. So, I mean, it's so incestuous.
But don't you think that, you know, the government officials that do things like that, Burl, are doing that to hook in the criminals? They're not criminals.
Nah, I think they're lying in their pockets.
You think so?
Well, remember we had Jerry Estes on. She was talking about how just in the Tenderloin she had the vice cops in her pockets. She had the judges in the pockets. She had the cops in her pockets.
Yeah, low-level stuff.
Yeah, well, it's the same. Macrocosm, microcosm. It's the same principle.
You think
supply.
So? So I'm to look at like a guy like J. Edgar Hoover and not respect his homosexuality?
I never respected him because he was a loved Hitler.
I don't think he looked good in the dress, personally.
No, what do you think, Ron?
Yeah, he definitely didn't look good in the dress.
No, I mean the other stuff.
Oh, God. Yeah, so this is what happens about three-quarters of the way through the show.
Well, you know, I'll tell you my Hoover story if you're interested.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Well, I went to a predominantly black school in the 70s. I got a master's degree from Atlanta University, and I was a assistant to one of the professors. I remember the day Hoover died. They were literally cheering on campus. I mean, they hated that guy because of his campaign against Martin Luther King.
Sure.
And right. I was shocked by just the absolute hate of Hoover. And I found out later that he was like the most reviled, white guy ever in American history for the black community.
Well, have you ever seen the love letters that he was writing to Goebbels and Hitler and those guys? I mean, it's just horrifying.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
he was a big supporter of Hitler until we went to war with him. then he had to change his mind.
Then he had to politically switch teams.
So, yeah, but the FBI didn't have anything to do with Matthews, which is kind of interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it was strictly marshals and DEA and NYPD and cops, around the very.
Now, why wasn't the FBI ever involved in this?
I don't know.
I think, first of all, he was African American and was looked upon probably as not a. Those days, they were looking at the five families as running things, and this guy's kind of a street thug.
Right.
So, that was my guess on that, and it's strictly a guess, but, we're talking a guy that was looked upon, and that's how he was able to, because he's smart as a tack, he was happy to be looked upon as a street thug, I think.
Right.
And then just get away with nothing but murder and money.
That's right. He was very good at keeping under the radar. And the way the documentary describes it, it was just pure luck while they just stumbled on this guy.
Oh, that's a great story.
By a weird coincidence, a cop from the NYPD was living in the same apartment building as Matthews on Clarkson Avenue in Brooklyn, and he saw all these guys coming in, Superfly looking guys, with big cars, just carrying in. He got really suspicious, of course, and he started his own investigation. And it took him like almost 18 months, and then he presented it to the NYPD. And they were shocked, that this was going on. Because he did a search on him, he used the databases, and he found out how big this guy was. And nobody knew about it.
That's even though American Gangster was almost entirely fiction, there's a parallel where Russell Crowe has done this investigation and presents the information on how big of a criminal this guy is, and all the superiors look at him and go, "You're out of your mind. Go away."
Right, right. Well, that's the way it was with Frank Matthews, and then once they started to investigate how he was operating. And how much money he was making, then it got really serious because they realized that this guy was, Mr. Big.
So maybe they set him up, the government had him killed, and the government agents that had him killed took off with the dough.
Well, any theory, given the lack of facts surrounding his whereabouts, or what happened to him, any theory really is as good as any theory is a guess.
I'm having a tough time. Just given what you've presented for me in the documentary and then here today, I'm having a tough time. Again, I'm backing up about a half hour, but it's hard for me to see a guy at age 29 who is just flying.
I'll tell you what he did, Howard. This is what Burl Bear thinks. Burl Bear thinks he did have plastic surgery, no longer looks African-American, looks Hispanic, and became one of the drug lords in South and Central America.
Well, you remember, we mentioned Frank Bender. You remember the famous forensic sculptor?
Mm-hmm.
They even brought him on the case, and he did a sculpt a bust of Frank Matthews, what he would look like. Of course, it wasn't plastic surgery. It would be what he looked like if he was still around today.
68 years old, yeah.
Right, right on that. But, You remember the marshal in the documentary? I pinned him down, you know, because I was doing the interviews, and you know, I said, you know, what evidence do you, you know? And the truth was, he spent 10 years on the case, and he didn't have anything, which was just unbelievably mind-boggling to me and very frustrating to him. You can see the frustration on the screen because they never had a. He said, this is his own words. They never had a solid lead.
In 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, they had, you know, they were working full time on this case because this guy, you know,
they're working full time with nothing, with bupkis.
Let me ask you this: right. Has any major network done any kind of short form piece on this guy?
No.
Look at Dateline.
No, and when I was researching this for, I was cringing because I thought American Gangster would do something, you know, that series on Black Entertainment Television. I thought maybe Gangland, and nobody has done. He's been kind of lucky in a way. He sort of dropped in under the radar for some reason. I don't know why. You know, he hasn't gotten more attention because you know the story, as you saw the documentary, is just fascinating and it's so rich, you know, and so different. I mean, there's so many different. And he was the Al Capone of black gangsters. You know,
I want to go back here for a second when Freeway Ricky Ross, you know, originally got life in prison,
right,
and then. Because the Freeway Ricky Ross task force was more corrupt than Freeway Ricky Ross, those guys wind up, the cops wind up going to the slammer or whatever. They cut Ricky down to 25 years, and then they finally let him out. Now, the first time he was supposed to be on the show, they wouldn't let him come because he'd been seen on the internet chatting, you know, on a conversation with another convicted felon. He's not supposed to associate
right.
with convicted
right.
felons. So, but he came on the show here and he says, listen, if I'm not supposed to associate with other convicted felons, I live in the hood. Is who else am I going to associate with? Just come take me away right now.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, if Frank's listening in the show, I would advise him to
Hi,
come
Frank.
In. Yeah, I would advise him to come in, you know, because I think he could beat and you know, beat every charge, and I think he might, you know, with a good lawyer, the only thing he's going to have to worry about is jumping bond, but I think that he could probably work out a deal because there'd be so much interest, you know, with him. And you know, Sheryl Brown, they never wanted her. All she wanted was a material arrest warrant, you know. She was a potential witness. And when I was talking to the marshals, I was in their office, I said, please, let me have a picture of her. I want to see what she is, and could I have a copy, you know, for the document? And they said, we have to check to see if there's anything outstanding against her. So they went and checked, and they said, no, there's nothing outstanding against her. We can't give you the picture. And so, you know, she walks in off the street into the marshal's office and says, here I am. They say, great, go home.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's nothing. So that's another reason, as you were saying, you know, that, you know, that's a good possibility he could be dead.
Well, from another perspective of going through the material, you have an individual that we're speculating is a type A personality and needs to mm-hmm. be in the spotlight. Mm-hmm. But everything that he did prior to his empire crumbling was recognize the writing on the wall and do everything he could to make sure that his escape was clean. Mm-hmm. That says to me, I have the discipline to set that up months, a year and a half in advance. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go and recidivate. Unless he gets to the point wherever he is where he feels comfortable and goes back,
right.
He's going to disappear because he set it up to disappear.
Right.
And you make the analogy with the Kaiser Sose. Did you ever interview Kevin Spacey? I'm sorry.
No. No.
The same kind of thing applies through the whole thread. It's the poof, he'll be gone. Mentality. Once he eliminates the witness to who he is, he
right.
has no further need to be in crime. He can go back and take his money and sit back and rest and enjoy the rest
right.
of his
life. Kind of like Gabe
right.
Kaplan.
Right. Well, you know,
you're
talking, even the discipline, we're talking about you being disciplined and all this, and you know, being flamboyant. I mean, there's strong evidence, which is disputed by people that knew him, that he had a cocaine habit, too. And you remember in the documentary, he had a irregular heartbeat. That's what the prosecutor said, which I've never been able to verify. And then, you know, that really strange story where he was supposed to have shown up in Houston for a heart transplant. And a woman, one of his girlfriends, insisted that he was in Houston, and Houston, of course, is a major medical center, and the marshals were checking everything out. So they sent their agents down there to check it out, and never checked out on that. But again, this is part of the incredible mystery of this guy. I mean, everything, every side that you point out has another side,
which is just as
logical and it's just as convincing as the other side, whether he's alive or dead.
Ryan, you've got enough for another one. You can do another hour and a half.
Well, we've got several new sources that we want to bring into this and explore this.
And this was done with your buddy Al Prophet.
Right, Al, that's his stage name.
Yeah.
His real name is Alan Bradley. Right, and he wanted to be on the show, but he was in production.
Next time, maybe. Nate, yeah. Hey, by the way, if you ever make it to the West Coast, come join us live. What a lot of fun you were today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A great show here. I enjoy your show. It's a great show. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks.
Well, our pleasure. Thanks. We'll have you back again. Ron Chepsik and Frank Matthews' story. It's frankmatthewsmovie.com. You can download it. It's the download.
Can have it in a minute.
His other works and his production company.
Yeah, lots of good stuff.
And his publishing company.
Now, next week, we got something really unusual. I don't have her name in front of me. She's up in Bellingham, Washington.
She's not a crime hottie?
She's a hottie, all right. And she has a site on solving unsolved crimes. She gives you all the information, all the background stuff, and then you get to try to work it out.
Cold
cases is fascinating.
It's going to be fun.
Yes, it will. I promise.
Speaking of fun, what could be more entertaining than Magic Matt Allen and the Demons of Decadence live from the Lighten Up Lounge? Well, you probably have your own list, and we all do. But until then, we'll just enjoy Magic Matt Allen, the Demons of Decadence, live from the Lighten Up Lounge.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.